someone goes to a nightclub and they seem to be partying and it's all happy and they're dancing, but they can leave there with a very empty feeling. On the opposite, they could listen to a rather tragic piece of Tchaikovsky, but feel ennobled in a way in their spirit. So we have to each discern the effect that certain music has on us. Go.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's the host of Faith and Culture, Joseph Pierce.
Hello, and welcome to another Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute. I'm your host, Joseph Pierce, and I'm delighted to have back for the second part of our discussion on the book The Sound of Beauty, a classical composer on music and the spiritual life, my good friend Michael Kurek. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, in the last discussion, we discussed the first four chapters of the book. The last we were talking about how contemporary classical music communicates or does not communicate, more to the point, to the culture. And now we have chapter five, you talk about contemporary popular music and how that does or does not communicate to the culture. So would you like to say something about contemporary popular music?
Well, there are a couple of things I cover especially strongly in there. One is how to deal with formation of your children in this culture that's inundated with popular music, and sometimes where your own children are learning to play an instrument, and how do they negotiate the ego and the jealousy and all the things that come with learning an instrument. Another thing is the sociology of how music is used in our culture. We have kind of cultural rituals. For example, football games, you hear the national anthem or the school fight song when they make a touchdown. Whereas in a wedding, you'll hear the wedding march. In a Oktoberfest, you'll hear German music. And, you know, you won't hear a Spanish mariachi band at Oktoberfest and so on. So we have music that's associated with events, and which is very much shared, a cultural shared experience. So that's one thing. And then just dealing with the content of how much virtue or lack of virtue there is in music, and how to judge that and create your own listening diet. That's all that comes to mind at the moment.
Well, there's one thing I was sort of thinking about in this. I appreciate your comments on it, because it seemed to me that in history, in the broadest sense of the word, you could talk about there being two types of music that became known as what we might call folk music and classical music. And classical music perhaps began with liturgical music, you know, with the music of the church, the music of the liturgy. Mm-hmm. And then perhaps with the secularization of culture, it broadened out into the whole panorama of what we would now call, in the broadest sense of the word, classical music. And against that, you always had what we could call folk music. In other words, the music or popular music of the people, which was not as highbrow, it did not take as much skill to compose or to play. Right. But it seems to me now there's a third type of music, which is hideously new, which I call at least industrial music. And this is music that's really produced by technology, produced in the studio with the use of computers, where very little actual individual talent in terms of playing a music instrument or singing is required. And it emphasizes beat and chant rather than singing and melody. Would you agree with that, or am I going too far?
I would agree with it. I think that there's an emphasis also on the text, on the what they're saying when they intone their chants over these mechanized beats. It's about the expression of the rhyming text in the case of rap, but and the music is secondary. There's no melody really in, you know, as we understood melody traditionally, maybe there's only a few notes range involved, and so it's, or it's just spoken, and then there's just simple little pattern of a few notes that's played over and over and over, and it's sort of mesmerizing in a way, but it's dehumanizing also. Because
right, but I mean, in one sense, I mean, to play devil's advocate here, that would be true of all folk music. I mean, you know, that Irish music sounds similar. The early, I mean, blues, early rock and roll music, which sort of derived from blues and rockabilly and hillbilly music and mountain
melody,
music.
That has melody.
And, yes,
and expression, and under, and that melody is underpinned by expressive harmony, which is, even though it's simpler, there's only a few chords, they're very expressive chords, and they contain a language of tension and resolution, which turns into an emotional expression, and what we call non-harmonic tones, tones that are not in the chord that resolve into the chord. So that there's a kind of yearning. And so you get this very yearning sound in some folk music, which is very expressive and very human. And so it's quite a few rungs up from this technological music, which is just...
What I see is that the pattern. Industrialization of music is ultimately a usurping of the folk music. It's sort of... it's destroyed folk music, really, because it's become big business and big technology and computer-generated, and the actual... The musical abilities have been minimized, basically.
Well, and along with the visual component that they stress in the videos and their costumes, outrageous costumes and situations in videos, it all creates a kind of entertainment package, but musically and substantively very dumbed down in terms of what would nourish the soul from ordinarily from music.
Yes, it's exhibitionism, perhaps, rather than anything that could be called music.
And I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to the next chapter in the book, and that's chapter 6, on a more edifying level. Not that it could be much less edifying than the topic of industrial music we've just been talking about. Chapter 6 is called How Music Communicates to the Spiritual Soul. So we're now transcending, going deeper than mere psychology, should we say, to the deepest needs of the human spirit as being made in the image of God. So how does music communicate to the spirit of man?
I believe that there is a kind of transcendent message that music imparts as a whole. And when you listen, music is an art through time. And unfolds through time, and you, just as a book must be read from beginning to end. But when the passage of music or the composition is finished, it leaves an impression as a whole. So I mentioned in the book that it's hard to, if someone has heard the piece Clair de Lune, which is very beautiful by Debussy, if you just mention the title, you see a dreamy look come over their face because they remember the piece as a whole. They might not be able to even sing it back, but you know, and I mentioned, I used the example of Uriah Heep in Dickens. The description is so graphic and colorful of him that we don't necessarily can't quote it, but we have a picture of him as a human, as a person in our mind that's transcendent of any individual word in the description. And music acts on our soul. One of the things I discuss is the rules for spiritual or exercises in discernment of the spirit by St. Ignatius of Loyola. How does the music make you feel when it's over and when you've absorbed its collective message? Is it a message of victory, of hope, of optimism, or is it a message that leaves you feeling empty and despairing? And even in the case of certain popular music, like you were just mentioning, someone goes to a nightclub and they seem to be partying and it's all happy and they're dancing, but they can leave there with a very empty feeling. Whereas they can listen to, on the opposite, they could listen to a rather tragic piece of Tchaikovsky, but feel great compassion and feel ennobled in a way in their spirit. So we have to each discern the effect that certain music has on us and choose actively what to listen to and not just passively. In the previous chapter, I talked about active listening and passive listening, where you choose your own music and carefully as a Catholic, and you don't let you just turn on the radio and let someone else choose it for you.
Well, would you say in that case then, because one thing that I often say is obviously the choice of which books to read is a moral act.
Exactly.
And the choice of what every dollar we spend is a moral act, a moral choice. Would you say the same thing about every piece of music we listen to is a moral choice, which means it can actually be a sinful action?
Yes, and but it's very individual. I mean, there's prudential judgment involved. And I knew a woman who could not listen to Tchaikovsky because it made her too nervous. She was prone to neuroses, and she had to listen to Bach because it was even and steady, and it didn't have, she said, Tchaikovsky had too many climaxes. For someone else, it might be thrilling. So we each have to kind of learn to discern what music's effect is upon us personally. Now, if there are intrinsic evils like a song lyrics advocating for abortion, well, then, of course, that's a deal breaker.
Right, absolutely. All right, let's move on. We're going to go further up and further in, as C.S. Lewis might say now, because we're going to go to chapter 7, which is the immanence and transcendence of music in worship. So now we move, if you like, perhaps the deepest and highest purpose of music in assisting us to worship the Lord in the liturgy and elsewhere. So can you tell us something about how you handle the immanence and transcendence of music in worship in chapter 7 of the book?
I talk about the philosophy of worship in the Catholic liturgy, and it's quite surprising to someone who is in a Protestant worship paradigm, which often involves entertainment and someone standing up at the front singing beautifully and from the heart, and it moves you. You want to applaud, and some churches do applaud. But in Catholicism, the worship is not designed to entertain us. In fact, we're told in the documents of the church that music should be different than the music from entertainment. Its purpose is to set a sacred atmosphere in the presence of God in the tabernacle. We're entering a holy place that's like no other place when we come into the nave of the church, if assuming the tabernacle is up there in the sanctuary. We're in the presence of God in the Eucharist. And I think we've lost that sense generally. People just talk and they don't have a sense that they're in this holy place. And so music is to create a holy environment along with the statuary and the sacred art and the architecture, so that you're entering this place that really causes you to reflect, to think about your own sins, and to prepare yourself to receive the Lord in the Eucharist.
So, yeah, so basically what struck me in what you were saying there is that if music in the liturgy is entertaining, it is ipso facto a distraction. Mm-hmm. And if it's distracting us from the worship, which is the purpose of our being there, then it's not only is it neutral, it's actually a negative as regards what it's doing.
Exactly, yeah. And it also, we're told that in the general instruction of the Roman Missal, that we're not to, no person is to receive special honors and recognition in the liturgy of the Mass. It's not about people, it's about God. Even the priest wears vestments to look anonymous like every other priest, and not to be a flamboyant preacher, you know, dressed in an orange shirt or something. So we don't bring attention to and glory to individuals by applauding them, by admiring their own talent, because that distracts, as you say, from God's glory and the attention upon God.
And for the people, the actual, for the want of a better word, the performers themselves, it's actually can have a negative impact upon their own spiritual life, because it's going to play a massage to their ego, to their ambition, to their to pride, to the sin of pride. It really, we should offer our gifts, if you like, in anonymity within the liturgy.
And the general instruction of the Roman Missal also reinforces that by the placement of the musicians in the church. The musicians and choir, if you will, are to be facing the altar the same way the people are. They're not to be facing the people.
Right.
And so they are worshiping along with the people and should even have kneelers if possible. That's why the choir loft in the back is ideal, because they can have pews and kneelers, and they can be on the side, but outside of the sanctuary, not in the sanctuary.
Yes, basically we should all be facing towards the Lord, right. Yeah, not towards each other in liturgy. All right, let's move on to chapter 8, the penultimate chapter in your book, and that's what the Vatican II documents and other church documents on music really say.
And well, obviously, we've actually got into that already.
So. Yeah, I mean, obviously the suggestion there is what the documents really say is suggestive,
really?
But actually, you know, what the documents say and what people think they say or say they say are not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, and I've mentioned some particulars, but let me just put this, that people have used Vatican II, or, quote, the spirit of Vatican II, to pretty much do whatever they want. And if you actually read the Musicum Sacrum, which is the document on music from Vatican II, or the parts about music in Sacro Sanctum Concilium, the worship document from Vatican II, you see that those documents expressly forbid some of the things people have done in the name of Vatican II. For example, the organ is supposed to be the principal instrument, and instruments that are primarily associated with worldly entertainment should not be there unless they're compatible with the organ. And so it just as chant is also supposed to have pride of place. So yeah, these are the people just need to familiarize themselves with the documents. And that's why we've reprinted those documents in the back of the book. They can read them for themselves. So in the book, I'm not giving my opinions. I say at the beginning of these chapters, this is not my opinion of what worship should be, but this is what the church teaches.
Yeah, so there are several appendices at the back that are the church documents on music in the liturgy. So that's also another reason for buying this book. Just to wrap up our discussion, I would say, by the way, also there's an Appendix A, the first, which is a beginner's classical music playlist. I would love to have you back maybe to go through that at some point, sort of, you know, classical music for Catholic beginners, so to speak.
Well, this comes because when I've spoken to lay audiences, people have come up to me and said, I've always wanted to listen to classical music, but I've been scared. I can't pronounce the names. I don't know where to begin. And when I try, it's sometimes very boring and over my head. So I've put together a list of really user-friendly pieces that anyone would love if they hear them.
All right. Well, perhaps we'll have you back to discuss that. But before we wrap up today, there is a final chapter, and it's an appropriate final chapter because it seems to be a conclusion in both senses of the word, not just an ending, but coming to an understanding. So chapter 9 is called A Call to Leadership. So what do you mean by a call to leadership? What are we called to do, and what are leaders called to do as regards the sound of beauty, as regards music?
Well, I've noticed that we have a lot of conferences that and articles and things that advocating that the church should retake leadership in the arts and be leaders for truth, goodness, and beauty in the arts. And yet I don't see that reflected in the curricula of our Catholic universities and colleges. And they often are small music programs, so they just turn out, you know, choir and liturgy directors, if anything. But if we really want to transform the culture with beautiful music, we need to be training composers to write that music, artists to paint those paintings. And I don't see that happening. St. Pope John Paul's second letter to artists talks about how we need to have artists who are skilled in making these products, and yet we're not training them. So someone like me is self-taught, and some of the other artists I know who are trying to regain and recapture truth, goodness, and beauty are essentially self-taught. But all they're teaching in the music schools, in secular music schools, is modernist techniques, and mostly. And in Catholic schools, they're just not teaching it at all. They either don't have a music major, or they only have a sacred music program. And it would be great to see some actual applied arts programs added to the curricula of Catholic colleges.
Oh, amen, brother. I couldn't say it any more clearly or more powerfully than that. That we do in a call to leadership is a call to the leaders of Catholic schools and colleges to actually bring music back onto the center of the curriculum to ensure that this aspect of the good, the true, and the beautiful can evangelize future generations and build a culture of goodness and truth. Michael Kurek, it's been an absolute joy and pleasure having you as a guest. Please do join me again in the future.
I would be happy to. Thank you.
Well, my guest today has been Michael Kurek, the author of The Sound of Beauty, a classical composer on music and the spiritual life, published by Ignatius Press. And I've been your host, Joseph Pierce. Thanks so much for joining me in this Faith and Culture podcast of the Augustine Institute. Goodbye and God bless.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture with Joseph Pierce. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.